Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
Welcome to a special topical edition of the Voices podcast, where we are exploring the recent decisions by several Western governments to recognize Palestinian statehood. During the recent UN General Assembly, several Western governments, including France, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Portugal, joined the overwhelming number of other countries around the world in recognizing the state of Palestine, 1 week after a UN special committee found Israel's actions in Gaza consistent with genocide. The decision of these Western governments to recognize Palestinian statehood and the timing of such a decision has generated considerable debate. In this episode, we are going to explore these debates, contextualize the struggle for Palestinian statehood, and delve deeper into the politics of recognition. And to do this, I am happy to be joined by two experts, Emile Badarin and Victor Catin. Dr. Emile Badarin is a researcher based in Oxford with a PhD in Middle East politics from the University of Exeter. He is the author of the recently published Recognition Politics in Settler Colonial States, Normalizing Dispossession and Elimination in Palestine, published by Bloomsbury in 2025, and Palestinian Political Discourse Between Exile and Occupation, published in 2016 by Routledge. In addition to his books, Emile is the author of a number of journal articles tackling the issue of coloniality and settler colonialism in Palestine, and the recognition of Palestinian statehood. Alongside this, he is a regular contributor to international media outlets on Palestinian politics, Israel's occupation, and the genocide in Gaza. Dr. Victor Catin is assistant professor in public international law at the University of Nottingham School of Law. He is the author of From Coexistence to Conquest, International Law and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1891 to 1949, published by Pluto Press in 2009. And The Palestine Question in International Law, published by the British Institute of International and Comparative Law in 2008, as well as a number of edited works tackling issues of violence, occupation, and partition. Alongside this, Victor engages regularly with the media around the world and has served as a legal advisor to the Palestinian Negotiation Affairs Department in Ramallah, and has advised the Palestinian leadership on treaty accession when it was conferred observer statehood by the UN General Assembly, amongst many other international advisory roles. Welcome to the podcast, Emile and Victor, and thank you for joining us to unpack the politics of Palestinian statehood recognition. Now, I'm going to start my questions by asking about the timing of the recent decisions by France, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Portugal, as well as a number of smaller nations, to recognize Palestinian statehood. Why now, when an overwhelming number of the world's states had already recognized Palestinian statehood in the 1980s and 1990s? Victor, do you want to kick us off first with that?
Sure, happy to. I guess the simple answer is that they were worried about upsetting the Americans and the Israelis, which is why they postponed the decision. I mean, it's kind of interesting because the UK already in 2011, during the Conservative Liberal coalition government, had already come out and said that Palestine met the conditions of statehood. in the Montevideo Convention. So, and well, they condition it on saying, so far as the occupation allows, Palestine is a state. And the reason why they did that in September 2011 is because Palestine had applied for membership of the United Nations and also had submitted around 8 conventions to UNESCO, and the UK was the depository state, so they had to do an assessment. And then the following year, in 2012, Palestine was given this observer status in the United Nations, and the UK kind of came out again and said that they were willing to vote in favor of the resolution, but they had certain conditions that they wanted the Palestinian government to meet. And the Palestinian government at that time, for various reasons, wasn't able or willing to openly meet those commitments. And then basically what happened is they kicked it down the road. They basically came up with this thing saying, you know, we will recognize Palestine when the time is right. So they basically said Palestine meets the conditions of statehood so far as the occupation allows, but politically we want to recognize it at a moment that contributes to peace. That was the language they used. And the reason why now, I think, is directly related to the conflict in Gaza. And again, we saw conservative leader David Cameron coming out January last year saying recognition didn't have to wait until the end of the conflict or wait until Israel withdrew from the occupied territories. It could be done prior to that. And what they were doing was building up a so-called coalition, moral minority, whatever you want to call it, of states. So they didn't do it alone. So no single state was taking on the American. So we saw Sweden do this in 2014, and then they faced a lot of backlash. So I think that's the reason for the timing of it. And that's why these states kind of did it collectively. I can also say more about, you know, those states that recognized Palestine in the 80s and 90s that your question also refers to. So, of course, it was the Arab countries that first recognized Palestine following the failed partition in 1947, 1948. And then it became, Palestine became kind of like a, in the 60s and 70s, seen as like a left-wing cause. And so, again, the reason why 1988 was the main moment was because at that time, Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, because they had claims, or there was a merger or a union, if you like, between the West Bank and the East Bank, and the King of Jordan, for because of the Intifada and for other reasons, decided that Jordan was going to recognize Palestine. They didn't recognize Israel's claims to the territory. And in that process, there was a meeting in Algeria being, you know, one of the foundational anti-colonial states. And so about 100 countries recognized Palestine then. So it's kind of like the socialist non-aligned movement bloc. The so-called Western states, global North states, kind of delayed the recognition. And there was this idea that it depended on Israel coming to an agreement with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Of course, that argument was flawed because Israel doesn't have title, doesn't have a right to those territories. And so what's happened now is kind of interesting. And the whole process of going to the International Court of Justice and getting the occupation declared unlawful and getting states to recognize Palestine is kind of saying, well, we don't need to wait for negotiations. Israel no longer has a veto. The Americans no longer have a veto. That's kind of like one of the reasons why recognition is kind of a useful political tool, although it's insufficient of itself, obviously. Yeah, but I'll let Emil jump in.
Thank you. To follow up on what Victor has said, the reason these states refused to recognize Palestine much earlier, what they tried to justify the rejection of recognition. They said always that the recognition comes after the Palestinians and the Israelis reach an agreement. So it should be something that should follow the bilateral agreements between the Palestinians and the Israelis. However, the circumstances have changed dramatically in the last 2 years. The timing is very much connected to the ongoing, to the current genocide in Gaza. And to be clear, let's be clear that most of these states that have recognized, come out and recognized Palestine, they are really complicit, not only in the genocide itself, but also in the conditions that made this genocide possible in the first place. The kind of reasoning they gave for rejecting Palestine or its recognition and so on. This is the background that got us to the current context in which this recognition takes place. And what we have been seeing during the last 2 years in most European capitals, there has been huge pressure on these governments, internal pressures, first to do something to stop this genocide and end their complicity in it and live up to their obligations under international law, under the Genocide Convention, etc. And historically, we have seen this pattern. Whenever there's a colonial violence in Palestine, whenever it reaches a certain level, a high level, these governments fall back on the familiar formula of the two-state solution, the rhetoric of the two-state solution and negotiation and peace and so on. So that's the familiar formula. They try to repackage the same Oslo peace process. But the truth is, the two-state solution itself, on which this recognition builds on, has lost its own credibility long, long time ago. It's not feasible. That formula has been overused to the point that even these governments, they know deep down it cannot deliver and it cannot be achieved on the ground. So this time they have added recognition. There was not much really left in the box to add to that rhetoric. So they added the formula of recognition, recognition of a Palestinian statehood, to make that discourse seem more appealing, more attractive, and sound as something serious. Yet they haven't done anything practical. They didn't even define what they are recognizing. We don't know what they have recognized, really. They said they recognize a Palestinian state, but what are the, you know, the borders? Does that include Jerusalem? Does it include, what does it mean? They never defined that. So there are no concrete plans. There are no budgets. There are no mechanisms to make that, you know, recognition real, which essentially make this recognition, as I alluded to earlier, an add-on to the same formula of the so-called two-state solution, which is a symbolic gesture meant really to pacify the outrage that we have in lots of European countries. So in the end, the choice these governments were faced with is between recognizing a statehood, a hypothetical statehood that doesn't exist, or recognizing a genocide and doing something concrete on the ground to stop it. They chose the easy option, which is recognition, because it costs nothing, it's free, and it helps them appear as if they are moral actors and they have done something without actually, in reality, committing anything practical to end the suffering and the dispossession of the Palestinian, in which they have been always part of from the start.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. So this sort of leads on then to my next question, which is, what does recognition then mean, statehood recognition then mean for Palestine, both legally and politically? So Emil, maybe you can carry on with that and then we'll move to Victor.
Sure. What does it mean legally? I mean, that's a very important question. I don't want to dismiss the legal importance of recognition, but I keep asking myself, yes, international law is important in principle, but we also have to ask ourselves, when has international law ever had a real leverage over Israel's settler colonialism? It didn't stop the genocide. It didn't stop the war crimes and crimes against humanity that we have been witnessing for the last 2 years in Gaza and the West Bank and elsewhere. It didn't even stop Western governments from ignoring international law, the rulings of the International Court of Justice, their obligations under the Geneva Convention and under the Genocide Convention. And they continued to arm and defend and support Israel in politically, economically, militarily, etc., in even in media and so on. So I wouldn't put much weight on international law in this particular context. Recognition of a Palestinian statehood doesn't mean really much in practice when the foundations of any state, which are the foundations of any state, are the people of that state and the land. And what we see in Palestine here, the systematic destruction of these two pillars, the continuous destruction of these two fundamental pillars of any state, with active support of these governments that have recognized Palestine. And that's the paradox in all of this. So on the one hand, you have the Palestinian land where this state supposed to stand on, which they recognize, is being systematically stolen, appropriated, and destroyed in the case of Gaza. Basically 90% of the homes has been destroyed. The infrastructures, schools, universities, everything is gone. And you have also, at the same time, systematic attacks on the second pillar, which is the people of that supposed state, are being systematically dispossessed, ethnically cleansed, and now facing a genocide. Now, when I assess these recognitions that you mentioned, I wouldn't look what they mean legally from an international law perspective. I will look at the terms attached to these terms. And when we examine what these Western states have said and have been doing, we find a very clear contradiction here. And we should pause there and ask, you know, even though recognition sounds positive and appealing, right? It's something everyone wants to have, and it's hard to resist. But in practice, it comes with very harmful conditions. When we inspect what has been recognized and what have been said and the recognitions and the conditions of this recognitions. So under this current framework of recognition that we have seen, the Palestinian self-determination and their right to sovereignty, etc., are reduced to symbolic gestures, and in reality, they're being undermined. For example, I give you just a few examples just to make this make clear sense. You will find in that recognition language that we have seen in the last at least year or 2 years even, that foreign governments take the right, assume the right to decide how and who should govern the Palestinians. And in practice, this weakens and destabilizes the Palestinian people. The fundamental pillar of that state is its people. It entrenches exclusion, marginalization, and fragmentation of that society for a long time. And they also take away the Palestinian right to resist their colonizer and take away their right to have the right and the capability to have self-defense. So they have to be forever demilitarized. They would not, it would, you know, as a state, will not have the capacity to defend itself and to have sovereignty whatsoever. But the important part here is taking that right, which is contradictory to international law, as you mentioned, because every colonized nation has the right to resist and fight its colonizer by any means, including armed struggle. Even the Palestinian education, for example, has to be run according to external and foreign directives and oversight. So why should the Palestinians, why should foreigners decide how the Palestinians educate their children? So you see here, the economy is the same thing. It will be subordinated to the Israeli economy under something what they called here an updated or a revised kind of Paris Protocol for the economic relations. So for me here, sovereignty requires the right and the capacity of self-defense, and that's this recognition undermines it. And self-determination should give the Palestinian actually the right and the capacity to have freedom to shape their own political, social, and economic future. The recognition that we are seeing today, these series of recognitions, undermine all of that. So the language of recognition, the positive language, the attractive language of statehood, self-determination, peace, and all that stuff, in practice, have been emptied of any substance and meaning. And in this way, recognition is turned into a formula, part of the same facade, the two-state solution, the peace process, all that stuff that has been part of the conditions that weakened the Palestinians and paved the way for continued disposition until we reached the moment of genocide that we have been actually watching in real time for the last 2 years.
Great. Victor, maybe you can give us some a perspective, maybe more from the on the legal aspects of recognition.
Sure, sure. So I think you might have mentioned I briefly served as an advisor to the on secondment from the United Nations to the Palestinian Negotiation Affairs Department 14 years ago. And at that time, there were no peace talks. So we were focusing on work at the United Nations level, including on statehood. And one of the main arguments in favor of recognition or trying to persuade countries to recognize Palestine or to give it an augmented status at the United Nations was its capacity to join certain bodies, international courts and the like. And the main one, of course, was always the International Criminal Court. And Palestine after it was conferred that status, joined the International Criminal Court in 2015. It's been a long road, but arrest warrants were issued about a year ago, or just over a year ago, for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Minister of Defense. And if you believe media reports, other warrants were being considered for Ben-Gvir and Smotrich as well. Those arrest warrants have been circulated and are making life difficult for the current Prime Minister of Israel. You will have seen when he went to Washington most recently, his flight path had to carefully avoid a number of European countries. There are outliers like Hungary, which invited him, but most countries are complying with that. So being a state does have concrete legal effects. And when we talk about the genocide in Gaza, there are multiple cases ongoing also before the International Court of Justice. And the wheels of justice move slowly, but they do move. And Netanyahu will not be prime minister forever. Neither will Trump be president of America forever. And these arrest warrants will still stand for however long they need to stand. So that's one concrete aspect that I think is important to mention about statehood. The other issue, I guess, is, so if you're a state, you have a right of self-defense. It's not just a right of resistance coming from self-determination, but as a state, you have an intrinsic right to protect the integrity of your state as an emanation of sovereignty. So, I mean, whether the Palestinian leadership understand that properly and articulate that more clearly remains to be seen. I mean, other concrete legal effects are, you know, it strengthens, you know, a lot of Palestinians are stateless. Now they can, you know, they can claim to be citizens of a state that's widely recognized, have a nationality that's recognized when they go overseas. They can have passports and travel. This whole notion that the territory is somehow disputed is severely weakened. You have this idea of sovereign immunity. So the Palestinian courts are immune from civil and criminal jurisdiction of other countries. That's important because, you know, in the 1990s and about 20 years ago, and even more recently, various groups in the United States were bringing claims under the Anti-Terrorism Act against the Palestinian government for hundreds of millions of dollars. That those cases will be much weaker, much more difficult to pursue. And of course, you have an exchange of ambassadors. Now, if we take the UK as an example, it's no longer a general mission. It's now an embassy with sovereign inviolability. The ambassador and his family will now have complete immunities, as will, and that will be the case for all Palestinian officials in all countries that recognize Palestine. I guess it also provides more legal certainty for trade and investments. You know, if you have a dispute between a Palestinian company and a European company, you know, before a British court, now a British court can say, well, Palestine exists as a state. We have to respect its laws. So it's not completely meaningless. But of course, the timing is horrible. You know, it sticks in the throat. You know, you've got a genocide and this is what they do. You know, can they do much more than simply issue a declaration recognizing Palestine? But there have also been sanctions as well. You know, we have seen Spain and other countries take quite large sanctions, withdrawing military, you know, no longer doing business with Israeli military companies and industries. I guess the strategic reason why other countries haven't done that is they probably wanted to see how Netanyahu reacted to the recognitions. And he was hinting he was going to do some big move in the West Bank, which they're already doing de facto in any event with Smotrich and the settlement administration. But he seems to have held back because there were discussions at the EU level about, you know, some kind of trade or withdrawing terms of preferential trade, and other states were looking at those measures and they haven't, I don't think they've been taken off the table. And one interesting thing is also official maps. You know, if you look at a map or an atlas or a globe, you usually see the West Bank and Gaza as kind of like shaded in a funny color. This is kind of like, we're not clear what this is. Now I assume most official maps will be saying this is now Palestine. It's not just occupied or disputed territory. So there are concrete things. I mean, the issue about not mentioning borders, for me, actually, I didn't see that as necessarily a bad thing, because, you know, you don't normally tell another state what its borders are. And of course, the Palestinian official position is the pre-1967 border. So it's kind of an ambiguous formulation that could mean the ceasefire lines in 1949 or the 1947 UN partition lines. Of course, the Israelis make they want the whole thing. So it's not necessarily a negative not to be so specific about what a state's borders are or what its capital city is, because that's really for the Palestinian people and their government to determine. And they may want to change that. You know, you can have two states, you can have a merger, you can have a confederation, But I think in the interim, it's important to have that kind of status because of all the things that it allows a Palestinian state to do that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise.
Thank you so much. So I think the discussion so far has shown that this decision for these Western governments to recognize Palestinian statehood, given the timing, given the context that, there's an ongoing genocide going on, the occupation continues, that, of course, in certain cases, as with the UK government, it was sort of appeared to use it not as necessarily a commitment to Palestinian self-determination, but as actually a threat to Israel. So we can see that this stirred up a lot of debate and a lot of contention amongst the people who pay attention to these things. So I want to ask you both as experts who have long grappled with this question of statehood, and not just, of course, in academic terms, why has this decision generated such debate?
I mean, in the UK, we have after Keir Starmer announced that he was going to. So what he did is I think it was in July after Macron said France is going to recognize Palestine. Then Trump came along, he had a meeting with Trump. And then after that meeting, he said the UK was also going to do so. And then this kicked up a big furore. But it was very specific in the UK. It was a group of mostly Jewish lawyers, peers of the realm, who published this article in the Times front page, gave it a big spread. And they started to rake things from the past and say, you have to go back to the Montevideo Convention, even though this had all been, the British government had already done this assessment 15 years ago. In 2011, and it was already too late anyhow. So they made the argument that this was punishment for Israel. Again, I don't agree with that because this all began with a deal between MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, the Prime Minister of France, and Mahmoud Abbas. And it began with a letter that Mahmoud Abbas sent to Macron in which he laid out conditions, one of which was to hold elections next year. And there were other things he said. And reform the Palestinian Authority, blah, blah, blah. And that kind of initiated the process. And then Macron said, okay, in light of these things that you've said, we're going to recognize you at the UN in September. And then the UK came along and, the UK had to add a few things. But if I recall correctly, Keir Starmer, one of the issues was, stop starving people in Gaza, let unimpeded humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. He also said, importantly, no annexations of the West Bank. I think there was something else. The way I saw that was he was putting conditions on Israel that he knew the Israeli government could never meet. The coalition government would collapse if they even said that they weren't going to annex the West Bank. So then as soon as he said that in July, it was clear to me that it's a foregone conclusion that the recognition is going to happen. Some people were still worried it wasn't going to happen. I was like, there's no way Netanyahu can meet those conditions. So it's just kind of like a way of doing that. And I also saw it positively because historically, if we think of Oslo, they're always placing conditions on Palestinians. You've got to be democratic, you've got to renounce violence, you've got to be good government, you've got to be democracy, et cetera, et cetera. This time, they were also imposing obligations on the occupying power. So for me, that was quite interesting because that's kind of reversing the previous situation. Of course, they imposed obligations on Hamas. So they were kind of like aiming at different parties, knowing full well that Israel and the armed resistance in Gaza couldn't meet the conditions they were requiring, which would inevitably lead to the recognition. So that's kind of how I read the situation. And lo and behold, the UK did recognize Palestine in September, along with another 9 countries.
Emil?
For me, it's difficult to see them as threats. Now, yes, the UK framed the recognition of Palestine, or actually the non-recognition of Palestine, on certain conditions that the Israeli government need to do by September. Of course, they didn't do, and the UK knows that they were not intending to do anyway. But to consider these conditions as a threat is, I think, a bit too much for me, because in reality, they were not meaningful threats. We know the UK is completely on board, has been supporting Israel with what it has been doing for a very, very long time, not only in the last 2 years in the genocide. So at best, this language that was used by Prime Minister Starmer is really performative at best, I would say. So the whole issue of recognition for me, I see it as a distraction, and that kind of threat is distraction from the real issues that we needed to deal with, especially now, especially during the last 2 years, when you have 2.3 million people are being basically slaughtered on daily basis, and we were watching it, you know, in our screens every single minute. And that's what we needed to do taken care of. That's what needed to be stopped. Not a declaration that we recognize a Palestinian state, hypothetical one that doesn't exist, and I don't think it will exist. As with the way I see how the West Bank is, how Gaza is, the West Bank is in practice annexed. Like, there's not much left of it. Every single village, every single town is basically locked up, is like a small prison cells. So I can't see that recognition making anything real. And what makes things even worse, the whole issue of recognition has already faded in the rear view mirror, because it is intended to be meaningless from the beginning. And these governments that recognized Palestine just 2 weeks later, I think, they endorsed a plan, Trump peace plan, the 20-point plan, that in practice destroys, kills any idea of having of a Palestinian state anywhere. So I don't see how that recognition or that threat or all of these controversies making any sense when you are recognizing an independent state and at the same time you're supporting a plan that puts the state and the people you're recognizing under foreign government led by Tony Blair and Trump. It doesn't, that's why I'm telling you, like, all of this stuff doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. And it's all a distraction from the real issue, which is the genocide that has been going on in Gaza. So that's how I see it. And I agree with what Victor said about, you know, the legal value of recognition and all that stuff. But I just also look at the reality on the ground, number one. And also I look at the conditions attached to these recognitions. And this is very, very important, I believe.
Yeah, I think the practical nature of self-determination and sovereignty or territorial sovereignty while areas A, B and C still exist is a very important point for everybody to keep in mind. Victor, now you've started to tell us that you have, of course, worked academically on this issue for a long time, but you've also worked diplomatically, right, on secondment with the Palestinian leadership. So perhaps I can ask you then, from what you know of the Palestinian leadership, what you know of the Palestinian Authority, what this recognition means to this leadership. And you've already sort of started to tell us what this means in terms of diplomatic recognition of ambassadors and this whatnot. But, you know, if you could maybe unpack a little bit more, maybe what people like Abbas and people sitting in Ramallah are thinking about this recognition.
Well, I've never met Abbas, so I don't know what he what he thinks. I did meet Sy Berekat, but he's passed away, sadly, during COVID. But I'm sure he'd be happy, but also horrified at what is happening in Gaza. I mean, for Palestinian diplomats who've been working on this for decades, it's obviously a bittersweet moment. They're happy, but they're not so happy. So I happened to be in London, coincidentally, on the day the embassy, the Palestinian embassy, opened. So I just popped down to see the speeches, and they were very moving. And they were talking about the genocide. They were belated. They were very critical of the Brits. So they spoke about the Balfour Declaration and the history. So I think it's meaningful for them, but it's not. But they know, obviously, this is a sideshow compared to what needs to happen. And the main focus of all the work in the United Nations is really trying to stop the conflict and to encourage. And you've seen the hard work that all the Palestinian diplomats are doing at the United Nations all the time. Trying to get countries to enforce international law. That's where it's really heading now. And they've been partially successful with, you know, this new grouping of states, mainly in Latin America and the Global South, the Hague Group, and I guess also successful in raising the issue amongst civil society. So we saw, for example, that there was a big debate in the Labour Party about recognition. Now that's finished, they've moved on to the next thing, which is ending the genocide. So we saw the Labour Party adopt a motion a couple of weeks ago calling on the government to recognise it as a genocide and to stop it, including full embargo on trade and on military, the buying and selling arms. So that's where the debate is going. And I think that I think that will cascade, because I don't think this 20-point plan is going anywhere at all, I think is nonsense. I think it was a photo op for President Trump and his sidekick son, Jared Kushner. You know, whenever I see Kushner's involved with something, I always know it's going to go nowhere. But they did. They did. They were successful in that. This, in the sense that they got the hostages released. So it's kind of successful from there. From the Israeli point of view, my fear now is that once Hamas has given all the bodies, returned all the bodies, if they're able to, the war will just start again. I'm not at all hopeful that this plan will go anywhere. But there is a movement, there is a mass movement in Europe. I think Palestinian diplomats are intrigued by that. They feel like there has been a change in opinion, mainly in Western Europe. I think probably in North America, although it isn't playing out so much on the within the Trump administration. But it's a global movement. I mean, we're all seeing this everywhere. But the question is, how do you keep that going? How do you keep that going? Because obviously the governments that want to say this war's now over, go back home, you don't need to protest anymore. Our police are busy enough. But obviously the movement for change, nothing has changed. The people dying and starving, Gaza is a mass of rubble. As Emil said, that the West Bank is virtually annexed in all but name. Settlements are expanding, and the next stage really is sanctions and maintaining that pressure and the momentum on governments to do so. And the big challenge for me, if I was still advising the Palestinians, is not to forget the global South, because unfortunately many global South players have now become big dealers, you know, in India and even parts of Asia in trade and military weapons. And so, you know, it's all great. Europe ceases its trade. It's not great if then Israel can just find new customers elsewhere in the world. So I think that's where the direction has to go. I think there is momentum and there is anger with what Israel's doing, not just in Europe, in the global South. But that's an area I think that will need some more work.
Thank you. Fantastic. And thanks so much for bringing up the moves in civil society. And I think the change, the sort of sea change that we have seen in support of Palestine in the global North, as someone who's been working on this tangentially alongside with this for all of my adult life, I mean, the change is noticeable and marked. Like, you know, you used to have 500 people turn up to a demonstration in support of Palestine. Now you get millions, right? So I think that is something that we definitely need to keep that momentum going. Also in our own universities, right, where these struggles have been going on. Now, so Emil, in your work, you have critiqued the politics of recognition as legitimizing Israel's settler colonial project in Palestine. Can you explain for us how this works, right, theoretically, but also practically, and why you argue this? And therefore, with this in mind, how you view the recent decisions to recognize Palestinian statehood?
Thank you. Let me begin with your last question, why I do this. You remember in the late 80s, beginning of the 90s, the Palestinians, the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, was asked, you know, just recognize Israel and you will get basically everything you need. You just ask for, you'll have a state, you'll have, you know, economic prosperity. Gaza will be turned into Singapore of the Middle East, right? And we can see here, I look 32 years after the PLO, what was celebrated back then as the mutual recognition, whereby the PLO recognized Israel basically on 80% of Palestine. In return, it was recognized as the representative of the Palestinian people. And we see the outcome after three decades, right? The Palestine or anything was just basically disappearing. Gaza has become basically a massive place of a destroyed place, just all in rubble. So that's why I ask, where does this positive energy, positive spin around recognition come from? That's where I just began to ask, like, why recognition is something attractive to people. And in my work, I began to really dig deeper and take the sociological view of recognition, not just the state recognition and the legal arguments behind it, but look at from a broader perspective and look at it as the politics that's involved, the conditions, the grammar of recognition, and the power operations, the power relation in this recognition politics and struggle. And I found out actually the dominant frame of recognition is the way it has been framed for quite a very long time, for centuries at least. It was the liberal account of recognition. But if you dig deeper, you'll find other views on this. And here I found that actually recognition has a dark side. It doesn't always empower. It actually can be on the contrary. It can be a medium for erasure and elimination and destruction, especially in colonial situations, and even more so in a settler colonial conditions as we have in the case of Zionism and Israel. So recognition in many ways provides the moral and the normative scaffolding. That's what I found and what I argue in my work. It provides this normative scaffolding that makes elimination and the destruction of the indigenous people or the colonized appear as something normal, acceptable, and in some cases, something even necessary. So it gives a license, really, to the colonizers to erase and get, you know, do away with the indigenous people and make the colonizers at the same time appear as if they were humane and reasonable as well. And something what they're doing is really something just, you know, acceptable. And Zionism, when I studied the politics of recognition that has been used by the Zionist movement from its start, like from over like a century ago, has used politics of recognition exactly in this way to advance its settler colonial project with the help of the Europeans, of course, as a tool to transforming Palestine from how it was into a settler colony, into a settler project. And that happened from the start. So let me give you an example to make this even more concrete. Now here, we are asked to recognize that anti-Zionism, if you're critical of Zionism and Israel, etc., then you are basically an anti-Semite. They're trying to make this equivalency. And that's basically what politics of recognition does. That's where the struggle is now focused on. And for the indigenous people of Palestine, Zionism, as the ideological movement, and Israel, which embodies that movement, is a structure for their destruction, is the structure for the Palestinian destruction, dispossession, ethnic cleansing. And actually, the Zionists say they have a special term for ethnic cleansing. They call it transfer. And now, a structure of genocide. So if we accept this recognition demand to make this equivalency between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, reality will be turned on its head. First, and this is very important, it will make the Palestinian struggle for self-determination appear as something actually illegal, illegitimate, if you want, and even a racist, because to be an anti-Semite is a racist. And so you make that equation and recognize it, which is recognized by almost all Western governments and many of their institutions, universities, and this is quoted in the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, right? And at the same time, normalizes the settler colonial violence and makes it the default setup the background of what is could be considered to be as the normal situation and the source of justice and the source of normativity. So when we look at the recognition of the Palestinian statehood through this kind of lens, try to apply the same logic, look at the terms, look at the conditions, it becomes very clear that all of these recognition politics, whether it's the recognition of Palestine or whether the Zionist demands recognition of Palestine on the basis of the Western conditions attached to it, should be clear here, or the Zionist politics of recognition, there are many demands that ask people just, you need to recognize this and this and this. We will find here that the Palestinians are not going to achieve their self-determination through this process. On the contrary, I argue here, recognition, what it does, it continues and perpetuates a new colonial, if not a direct colonial governance, it would be a new colonial form of domination dressed up in the language, in this progressive language of peace, democracy, statehood, etc., and so on. But in reality, the fundamentals of that struggle, what the Palestinians are struggling for, is self-determination, is justice. This will not be achieved through recognition politics and through recognition that we have been given by these states.
Victor, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, because I found it very interesting what Emil was saying, and I agree, and I have maybe something I can add to what he's said. So historically, when you study recognition in international law, one of the curious features is the idea emanates from the 19th century, from the height of the European colonial confrontation or expansion. And then it was largely seen as something that was for civilized states only. And, you know, recognition was part of a way of joining this so-called club or society. And hence, most of the world was denied access to that club unless they met certain, unless they were considered civilized, which was, you know, cultural attributes mimicking European colonial powers. So it definitely has a dark history. And I was also intrigued by Emil's reference to the Zionist organization, because one of their first primary aims was to secure recognition as a state under public European public law. So there is definitely that dark side to it. But there's also another angle, which is the kind of anti-colonial view of national self-determination that comes from Marxist and Soviet theory, and which challenged that idea of that you have to be civilized to be a state. And so during the interwar years, and then playing out on the world stage during the height of UN decolonization in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s was, you know, this idea that all peoples, all colonized peoples, have a right to self-determination. And that right is not a right that can be prolonged or subject to external restraints. It's the antithesis of, say, the League of Nations mandate system or the UN trusteeship system. It's not dependent on an administering power deciding when and how a dependent people may be ready for self-government. But it was a right that was immediate and could be achieved through various means, including armed struggle. So they were very much in articulating that right of resistance. And that's one reason why the United Nations was really a small body of some 45 or so nations when it was established. And then today we fast forward, it's over 100 members. Of course, there are other states who haven't joined the United Nations, including Palestine. So the idea is that you don't have to be civilized anymore, but that hasn't stopped, that hasn't stopped the European states and the Americans and the global Northwestern states from trying to add these extra conditions. You know, if you want to join the European Union, you have to be democratic, rule of law abiding, etc. And then they try and apply that to, you know, beyond that to why they should recognize other countries. And with the collapse of the Soviet bloc, we don't see the kind of... We do, I guess they do still. I mean, maybe the Russians, and I haven't studied their foreign practice in as much detail, but I suspect that they don't agree necessarily on this issue. So Palestine's kind of caught in that trap because they were subject to the mandate system, that kind of colonial system. Although they were provisionally recognized, which is really interesting, as an independent nation, they couldn't yet stand alone until the Brits said they were ready. And that's kind of been... That notion keeps being recycled until now. But in some ways, I don't know, the European states coming out and recognizing Palestine with a few conditions, which they, you know, no one's going to meet. Maybe they've shifted to this other conception. So it's interesting that they didn't argue that the Palestinians have to abide by all these. I mean, maybe they did, because Abbas has to say he's going to have elections and all that stuff. So, yeah, I'm very sympathetic to what Emil has said. And basically, all I'm saying is I agree with what he said, and I'm just trying to add to it.
Interesting you bring up the mandate system, and because I was very surprised, well, not surprised, but intrigued when Namibia gave its evidence before the ICJ on the whether or not, you know, Israel was occupying Palestine, whether it was apartheid, that they drew actually on the fact that Palestine was a mandate like Namibia, and that within that mandate system, there was a promise, even if it was eventual, even if it was deferred, to self-determination. And I found it very interesting that Namibia sort of almost turned on its head this idea of that we see the mandate system as deferring, we see it as very paternalistic, but actually tried to use it as an argument for Palestinian liberation. So I was very inspired by that particular, you know, evidence given, especially as the Namibian woman giving it was wearing a keffiyeh with wonderful like jewelry. I mean, she was fantastic. And I thought it was just an interesting moment of sort of South-South, third world, we could say, solidarity, and an interesting way of kind of twisting and trying to make these international frameworks actually work for liberation. And so maybe then to end on a note of optimism, which seems a bit difficult to do under the current genocidal circumstances, even in the context of the recent ceasefire, right? I mean, there is a ceasefire, but it seems to be a ceasefire in name only because, you know, every day we see still tens of 20, 30, 40 Palestinians being killed in Gaza. What do each of you see for the future of Palestine, right? What needs to happen to achieve an end to the occupation, to achieve real Palestinian determination and sovereignty? And you're free to define these as you like, right? Whatever these look like. They are not agreed upon, right? And of course, then perhaps then, what is Palestinian liberation for you?
Sure. It's a very interesting question, a difficult one, especially to speak about the future in the middle of genocide. I mean, in my work, I knew that genocide, you know, I can feel that it's coming. And actually, I was writing that in a paper 2 months, less than a month before the genocide started in Gaza, warning, like, just for a paper, policy paper to an EU project should be, like, sent to EU policymakers. And I had a little bit of trouble for writing that, you know, these events and this kind of what was going in the West Bank, you know, the idea with the, they were just calling for like burning a whole city, wiping out, erasing, limchok, it was the exact word they used, erased Hawara back in the day. And I was saying this violence that was going on in the West Bank, settler violence, is actually hiding and is leading towards genocide. And that was, that language wasn't accepted just a month before the start, actually. The paper was published, or like a, not a paper, part of a paper, was published a month before that. So in my work, I feel that the genocide was coming, but it's different when you have it real and you know that the people you belong to are facing that. So I believe one thing I believe in and is the Sumud of the Palestinian people, their resolve and steadfastness in Palestine, and that enduring spirit of resistance, survival, creativity, whatever they do in their everyday life, I mean, that enables them to go on. So that struggle against this settler colonial project that has been going on for a very long time, and it's not only Israel, and that's another thing that we're dealing with. We know that, but it has been very clear during the last 2 years that when the Palestinians are not only fighting the Israel as a state, they're fighting basically a huge consortium of powers that really keep that violence going on. So for me, I see the Palestinian struggle, their Sumud resolve, as a struggle not only against that violence, which, but also a struggle for building a non-colonial future in Palestine. And when I think about liberation, I view it through the lens of Sumud, and I'm working on that, I have been working on this and now work more on its philosophy, the thought structure that underlie that. For me, liberation is not just about political independence and statehood. It is more about rebuilding and remaking Palestine on indigenous terms, which can be, the new reality, I see it as something grounded in Palestinian pluralist ways of being, their pluralist history, and their relationship to the land, which is non-possessive and non-colonial. So liberation means imagining and creating a future beyond the Euro-colonial frames of reference. And all these constraints that they put in recognitions, etc., that actually constrained us and constrained lots of the colonized people around the world. And we need to break free from these constraints, these frames of reference, and to build a future rooted in justice, equality for all, a non-colonial reality in Palestine. So we can turn it from now, which is literally the damned place on earth, to a place where non-colonial human existence or coexistence, which is in Arabic is very beautiful. It's called a ta'ayush, which has a different, it's not only coexistence, it's just you the way you live, living together, but you can't live without being dependent on other groups. And that these other groups are still part of yourself. You know, that's the kind of philosophy on which actually Sumud builds on. So that kind of future and kind of liberation I would like to see.
Beautiful. Thank you, Victor.
I very much agree with what Emil said so eloquently and powerfully. And I guess Palestinian liberation for me would be when the Israeli state can no longer interfere with Palestinian lives. So it's not just the horrible killings, which we're also seeing, but it's the daily humiliations, the checkpoints, the permit system would no longer be there. Palestinians can travel freely, don't have their homes destroyed, can live as normal citizens of any other self-governing state without those kind of restraints that are imposed on them by an occupying power. And in order to achieve that, the Israeli state has to be, become an international pariah, and it should remain so. And the way to enforce international law is, again, it's through sanctions, through trade embargoes, through similar to what happened in South Africa until they agreed to relinquish control. It's very hard to imagine what that might look like given what they are doing, and also to punish all the criminals who have committed these crimes, not just at the top, but also at the officer level. And, you know, these individuals go on holiday, you know, and they seem to be able to do that. So again, although there are groups who are assisting in trying to prosecute these individuals, but it's basically holding the Israeli state to account. I mean, again, if we talk about Gaza, who's going to pay for all the reconstruction, the rehabilitation? Is there ever going to be a reconciliation process? I can't see that happening now. So there's so many questions. But ultimately, Palestinian freedom, Palestinian liberation is for Palestinians to be able to live their own lives the way they want to live.
I think that's a perfect place to end. Yes. Thank you so much, both of you. I think this was a really important intervention. Thank you for agreeing to take part in it. And thank you for your candor and your expertise. Thank you.
Thank you, Polly. Thank you, Amin.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.